Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. My name is Marty Bennett. I'm your host and founder of SMIE Consulting. And today we'll be covering a broad range of topics related to international education that you may have seen crossing your news feeds over the last few days. For those that are not familiar with what we do at SMIE Consulting, we do this weekly roundup on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern as a way to share our thoughts on the top issues in our field this week in international education, and also share how ways that we think you may be able to adapt what you do in international education as a result of some of these news stories that are popping on our news feeds in the last few days. I'm looking forward to hearing from you today and catching what you have to say related to these three topics on international education, and hope that you can join the conversation as we begin today. As I said, we do this weekly on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern. And we also make this, in addition to the Facebook page where this is shown at SMIE Consulting LLC on Facebook, you'll also be able to watch episodes of this on our YouTube channel. And also, we podcast this for your benefit. And that podcast is available on all your favorite players from iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and Podbean. So we hope that you are able to catch this episode one way or the other. And today, for February 20th, we'll be covering the following three issues. For my work with IDP Connect, I do a series of monthly articles, and I'm in the middle of a series now on lessons learned, which looks at the two main events in the last 25 years in international education that have really shaped the way our profession, particularly in the United States, is. And what I've done now, I mean, just finished the second part of that series that came out about a week ago on the IDP Connect site. For those not familiar with IDP Connect, IDP, from Australia, the major network of agents overseas, has recently purchased Hot Courses Group, and the higher ed side of Hot Courses in the United States is now called IDP Connect, and it is, as it is globally. The profile sites that Hot Course manages are available in 12 different languages around the world. My work on the higher ed side is providing some perspective on top issues that can help U.S. institutions better deal with the challenges that they're facing. So what I'll share with you today is the second part of this series, which focuses on post 9/11 and what U.S. institutions, how U.S. institutions responded, and some of the key lessons that they learned during the response to 9/11. And as anyone who's been in the industry during that time will remember, 9/11 came right at the beginning of the fall travel season when classes were just enrolling on our U.S. campuses. And it really took, though the physical and emotional shock of what happened on that day was certainly felt immediately, the reality is the numbers of international students that were coming to the United States, the total numbers did not drop until 2 years later in the 2003-2004 Open Doors Report. So that's in response to that, a lot of trips, tours, and tours to the Middle East were canceled during that time. We also saw a lot of institutions kind of giving up on the Middle East as a recruitment area because of the introduction of Cevis and that new computer system, which was already been pre-approved but was accelerated with the implementation after 9/11, that it imposed a lot of new restrictions, particularly on the front end of the process, and after students got their I-20s and went for their visas at U.S. consulates and embassies abroad, Muslim students faced, particularly male Muslim students, faced significant challenges in securing visas because of mantis checks and secondary inspections and all secondary reviews. There was a wide range of kind of a mountain of circumstances that piled up that really made it difficult to recruit students from that region. But we also found that there was a resilience among U.S. institutions that we were not going to go down without a fight. And in fact, we found a new strength, I think, in international education circles with a series of initiatives that local state groups produced, as well as also other initiatives that took a recruitment, particularly to the Middle East, to a new level that hadn't been there previously. And there's some great data here that we'll share throughout throughout this process. But in terms of when did things start improving? We mentioned that the dip occurred for the first time in 2003, 2004, and didn't show positive growth again until 2006, 2007. So that was about a 3-year time period when enrollments were either down or flat from overseas. We're looking at that in kind of current day circumstances. So the other main event that, other than 9/11, that we're looking at in this series is the 2016 election and the impact that had. We've seen, though, numbers in 2017 and 2018 overall have been up, new international student enrollments have been down, according to the Open Doors report. So it'll be interesting to see if the patterns show correctly. 2019's report, Open Doors report, will probably be the first year of declines, overall declines in the total number of international students studying in the United States. But going back to 9/11, post-9/11, what happened and what really turned the corner for U.S. institutions and their international enrollment recruitment strategies? Well, certainly you find that one thing that really you saw that was kind of an answer, I don't know if it was a response to 9/11, but certainly in Saudi Arabia, where a number of the hijackers who were responsible for 9/11 attacks were citizens of Saudi Arabia, you saw the kingdom really respond in a way to show their support of international education and for their citizens to study abroad and have the opportunity to study outside their country. And that in 2016 was the launch, and excuse me, in 2005, the kingdom announced the expansion of their government scholarship program. They'd had a relatively small program up until that point, but in 2005, 4 years after the 9/11 attacks, they announced a huge expansion of the program. And that development also sparked other countries in the Gulf to grow their scholarships that they were providing, particularly from Kuwait, UAE, and Qatar. So you see that in 2006-7, the first time you see an uptick. But even at that time, Saudi Arabia was not the only new market that was popping up. You also saw kind of the initial seeds being planted for the rise of some current quite significant senders to the United States, Nepal, Brazil, and Vietnam. So what are some of the lessons that institutions learned in this time period? And the article that I've written takes kind of four main thrusts to ways institutions changed their ways of recruiting students to help improve their overall international enrollment situation. First is adapting to challenging circumstances and through diversifying markets. There were a number of institutions that refused to give up on the Middle East because they valued the diversity that those students brought to their campuses, and particularly in the post-9/11 world after the initial shock and reaction against Muslims in the United States, and particularly Muslim students, died away. There was still a strength of purpose among institutions to go after these students and bring them to our campuses and share what those students had to offer. But this was also a time where a number of institutions realized that they needed to diversify beyond the Middle East into other growth markets. India and China were beginning to explode, particularly at the undergraduate level. China, starting in the mid-2000s, that's when their undergraduate numbers started to really go through the roof, whereas previously undergraduates from China were in the definitive minority among the Chinese student population in the U.S. You also saw Indian numbers start to rise again. Brazil was coming onto the scene, as we said earlier, as well as Nepal and Vietnam. But it wasn't just about being in other markets. It meant having new messages. Because frankly, it was a time when When this was also the in the mid-2000s, the kind of the precursor of the internet was becoming much more widely available. Websites and other electronic means of communication were taking hold, and this was also a time when right as social media was coming onto the scene in the mid-2000s, where you saw a number of institutions investing in these new technologies to reach students, but also they were also seeing, if they weren't able to travel to particular regions, the advantages of doing virtual kind of projects with to recruit students in particular countries. But more and more, what you saw in the mid-2000s is, as a response to 9/11, is letting current students and parents really take their message to the fore of what you were doing. Because even after 9/11, no matter how much we like to say that our campuses were welcoming, the impression was, because of the post-9/11 security features that were added in place, the visa restrictions, the U.S. was seen as not as friendly to internationals. So I think at that time, the need was, instead of institutions telling their own stories, it needed to be in a different way. And students, current students and parents, alumni, were the ones who were best placed to help convince local audiences abroad that the United States still was the right place for their sons or daughters. So those are the adjusting of messaging, and the methods that institutions used to reach those students was key. But second, there was also a third, actually, is building new partnerships to show your commitment to international recruitment. So it meant, for once the Saudi government scholarships were announced, it means getting in on the ground floor with them and making the regular trips out to the Cultural Mission before it moved out to Virginia to their offices at the old Watergate Hotel. And that complex, where and other Gulf countries that were rolling out larger scholarship programs and getting on lists, this was always the thing. So building those partnerships, those regular trips there to those scholarship agencies. It also meant developing your local allies in your own state, because state consortia really started to take off in the early 2000s, and where I think in the when I was in Indiana, there were, I think, one of seven or eight consortia in existence. By 2013, there were 34 states that had consortium. My work with Destination Indiana from 2002 to 2008 to 9 certainly led to a lot of the work I did at Education USA in helping develop other state consortia and helping a resource for them as they develop social media tools or outreach tools to connect with students abroad, as well as Education USA abroad. At our time in Destination Indiana, we had over 150 advisors come to our campus over a 3-year period for campus visits to get to know our institutions better. And during that same period, we saw our international student numbers, where in 2002, when we were founded, Indiana was the 13th largest state destination for international students. By 2008, we were up to the 10th largest destination, our largest destination state. So it was through our our joint efforts as a state consortium, through our member colleges and universities, bringing Education USA advisors and going overseas together as groups, we had developed that consortium. And other states did similarly, and still to this day are providing great mechanism and way for institutions to join together and band together to help overseas students and parents really understand what we're all about. So the final piece of where our institutions really stepped up their game in the mid-2000s was by investing in their own current international student needs, meeting those needs more directly. That has it happened with the large increase in Saudi students coming to the United States and others from the Middle East. There were issues that needed to be addressed, campus food service during Ramadan especially, religious facilities nearby or on campus, access to those for students from the Middle East, addressing safety concerns. There was something at Destination Indiana we did in May 27, 2007. We held a joint program with Education USA advisors from Muslim countries, where we had 20 advisors from around the world come to a conference at IUPUI in Indianapolis and have a three-day workshop on what's happening, what are the issues involved, and in giving current student perspectives and advisor perspectives on these things. And this was also concurrent with a video that was released by, produced by the IUPUI Public Safety Office to help provide a resource to Saudi students that were coming to the IUPUI campus and ways to help educate them on what to do when you see a police officer or a public safety officer. So it's a great time in the post 9/11 world and at US campuses to pay more attention to what our students were saying and really focus on their needs to help better present a welcoming image to future students that would be coming. So that was the lessons learned piece from that I've written for IDP to Connect. And the next article in that series, part three, we'll start looking at applying a couple of those first messages here on lessons learned on adapting messages and diversifying markets, applying those to what's happened post-2016 election, and see how institutions today have been responding to this other major seismic shift in our international student enrollment landscape. So that's the first news story. So hopefully that provides you some decent information there about what's happening. The next article is from WES. It's a report from World Education Service on the dramatic drop, actually, in non-degree students over the last 4 years in the United States. So from 2014 to 2018, this report takes a look at the numbers from a high of in the United States of 93,587. That was an all-time high for non-degree students, international students in the United States, down to this past year's 65,631. So we got near a 30% drop in that period. And non-degree enrollment in the United States for international students falls into two main categories. One are those that are coming on exchanges or short-term programs, and the second is intensive English programs. Those two areas, particularly in intensive English programs, have seen dramatic drops in the last 4 years. And Lou, thank you again, one of our faithful joiners each week. Thanks for picking up and coming online. I'd be interested to hear your take on some of these, particularly these non-degree program, how you've seen this, seen changes in your time in the field. This WES report, you know, it focuses specifically on the 2014 from the peak of non-degree students in the U.S., again, IEP and exchange students, down to its low this past year, where in a four-year period it's dropped about 30%. And why the WES report attributes these drops specifically to two main scholarship programs that had either significantly reduced or completely eliminated student flows to the United States, which the majority of those were coming initially for intensive English, and that would be from Saudi Arabia and from Brazil with their scientific mobility program. We know about the Saudi scholarship program that we talked about from the last article that's had a huge expansion starting in 2005. Starting in 2015, 2016, those numbers started to plummet again after a restructuring of the government scholarships from Saudi Arabia. So we're seeing now with non-degree programs students coming to the United States that if you don't have these large groups like Brazil, like Saudi Arabia, that have these government scholarship programs to drive larger numbers to your institution, those programs, those exchange programs, are going to be down to your own success in developing institutional partnerships and or how well connected you are with those that are still sending intensive English students to the United States. Those numbers have dropped. So what has your campus been doing to kind of offset those? I had the unfortunate pleasure of being at an institution that had become heavily dependent on Saudi Arabia, as well as some other countries, Nepal and India, where though for English language students, they were the top three groups on our campus when I joined. It was right after the Saudis decided they were going to cut scholarships. and IEP programs across the country were starting to really worry about what next steps were going to be. And in the course of a year, we lost probably 60%, 70% of our intensive English students that were coming from these countries that were either government scholarships or for our graduate programs in particular, heavily dependent on conditional admits that required some English before they began the program. So there's a lot going on here with regards to the non-degree program declines. And the West report doesn't really present any solutions to this, and not saying that they should, but it just reemphasizes the point of having these funding sources for these IEP programs, that students generally aren't coming on their own in large numbers to pay for their own intensive English programs when they can get it, get that done in their own countries. So you we're seeing now what they do suggest some strategies. I should take that back about the West report. Their focus is, again, as we talked about earlier, on diversification. It talks about relationship cultivation, whether it's through Education USA, fairs, conference circuits, that type of thing. Being involved in outreach in other international ed conferences, partnerships with agents perhaps in underrepresented countries, developing short-term custom programs to meet the needs of not only student age, but also mid-level professionals that might be looking for short-term projects or certificates. So I think that there will be peaks and valleys, to be sure. If other governments come in with other scholarship schemes, I'm sure there may be a salad day again for IEPs, but it's a tough time right now, and a number of colleagues who work at IEPs are struggling at this point. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes in the coming weeks and months. But check out the West report, because it does provide, I think, some useful background for those that aren't as familiar or are looking for some ways to maybe adjust their strategies in the weeks and months to come. The final article I'm presenting today, and again, I post all the links to the articles in the comments section on the Facebook page, so do take a look at those and check in on those for future reference. The last piece is from Canada, a Pi News article about another double-digit growth for Canada, but potential concerns over diversity of their international student population. So the Pi is my favorite go-to source for international ed news these days, and they do a fantastic job of presenting timely and I think very useful information to international education professionals. What I do like about this article here, they've obviously got their folks on the ground in Canada to keep in touch with what's going on with news stories related to this field. You now see, according to figures from the IRCC, and that's Canada's main agency for reporting immigration-related statistics. The question raises: there are now over 572,415 study permit holders in Canada as of the end of 2018, and that's a 16% jump from the previous year. Last year, there was a jump of 20% overall in those same numbers. But what the article focuses on is not only the second consecutive increase, double-digit increase, but also the anomaly in the international ed circles these days is India surpassing China as the leading country of origin for international students in Canada. So they had a 40% increase from 2017 to 2018. So there are over 172,000 Indian students in Canada currently, as opposed to 142,000 Chinese. So the country was on a very good growth track already in the past 3 or 4 years, but really just, I won't say jump the shark, but really had a massive increase in the past year. Maybe a jump the shark moment, you don't know yet. But what we'll see with what's happening in Canada now, and certainly in the U.S., we realize in the Open Doors numbers from this past year certainly showed that Indian students, the numbers of of graduate applicants coming to the United States slowed dramatically. In fact, I think the overall numbers of graduate students were down 10%. No, I'm sorry, not 10%. They were down 2% overall this past year. But when you look a little bit deeper at those numbers, the lion's share of those decrease at the graduate level were Indian students that were no longer coming to the United States. And we can see very closely, clearly from the data, that that Canada was the main beneficiary. They have been on an upward trajectory anyway with recruitment in India, but to have a 40, literally a net of 40,000 students, almost 50,000 students in 1 year increase in terms of the number of Indian students studying in Canada over a 1 year period is pretty dramatic, and one that does warrant some concern, because like the United States, China and India do dominate, but to the extent there, no other country has more than 25,000 after China and India. So they account for a huge percentage of international students, of the total international student population on campus. And this is the challenge. And one of the quotes that I really kind of hone in on from this is that that international students coming to the United States is what the impact of such large percentages, where you have now for international students at some of these colleges, we've talked about this before in Canada, now represent anywhere from 30 to 70% from China and India of the international students at Canadian institutions. What's one particular institution at Niagara College in Ontario, they say that Fernando Gana or Garner has indicated, he talks about in the article, the predominance of one nationality can actually have a, when it exists, can actually prevent a future diversification or current diversification efforts. And he mentions his quote from the article that I really hone in on is, "Most domestic and international students are not comfortable when one culture is predominant above all others, as this takes away from a truly multicultural environment." So there's some kind of warning signs, and we've seen some of this before, particularly from India and China, as demonstrated on college campuses. For those of you who are not already signed up for Karen Fisher, she's a writer for the Chronicle of Higher Ed. She started a new weekly newsletter, also comes out on Mondays, just like our all the news, SMIE news fit to share. It comes out Mondays, but she's done a remarkable job, obviously, with her work at the Chronicle. She's has her has interviewed hundreds of students on these topics, but in particular China. She has an incredible series piece on in her newsletter, on it's called Latitudes is her newsletter. But the article itself references some challenges in Canada that Canadian student organizations are, in her words, colluding with the Chinese government to stamp out topics that are anti PRC government philosophy. And this would include freedom for Tibet. It would include the Uyghurs in northwest in Xinjiang province, in the northwest of China, that are have minority groups that are have been under been repressed by the Chinese government for many years. And when Canadian institutions would have speakers, and this is from Karen's story, when Canadian governments would have speakers on these topics, they would be shouted down, and the Chinese student organizations would ask the embassy, Chinese embassy in Ottawa, what do we do? What and they would provide resources to help them deal or respond to these speakers that might not be in line with Chinese government dogma. So interesting to see where that's going to go. But it's a really fascinating time in international education, and certainly I encourage all of you to follow Karen Fisher's or sign up for her newsletter as well called Latitudes. I do want to share, for those of you who are wondering, the news stories that I speak about each week here, I put into a newsletter and more. I put into a newsletter of my own that I started about since October this past year, or well, maybe August, where it's a newsletter of what's kind of top news stories each week. There's usually 10 or so international ed stories, 2 to 5 social media stories that I think are impactful for institutions that are involved in international education. So I encourage you to subscribe to that. I've just posted the link to that in the comments section. And also pop up the image for the SMIE website, smieconsulting.org. A lot of great free resources there, including an archive of these podcasts and live chats that you can access, and the podcast from this episode, as I mentioned at the top of the show. So I encourage you to check those resources out and visit our site. It's great to be connecting with you again this week, and look forward to hearing what you have to say in the weeks to come. And as always, please feel free to get in touch with us at smieconsulting.org. That's on our website. So look forward to catching up with you all next week, and do have a wonderful, wonderful week.